starting a rock band should only be done with the best of intentions. Playing the music you love so much, to be as close to it as possible in order to satiate your cravings and impulses, should be the only thoughts in your mind. Any ambition for success or fame should be afterthoughts. It's a truthful and honorable approach that I can proudly say we started with. Most bands I like have shared this mindset upon inception too. It's what helps make the music truthful, genuine, and powerful. There's an innate understanding in rock and roll that all bands must pay their dues, summarized best in the AC/DC song, "It's a Long Way to the Top if You Want to Rock and Roll." Gaining credibility is essential in order to be seen as authentic, and that only comes with experience. It usually takes a band a few albums to start being taken seriously within the scene, after they've been thoroughly vetted and run through the ringer. It's an unconscious initiation rite of passage. If a band can withstand van breakdowns, sleeping on floors, bad food, no sleep, bad reviews, and general bullying from all sides of the fence, then, and only then, can the business of scene acceptance begin. And still, after all is said and done in this rock and roll game, if the cream can be separated from the run of the mill, it still doesn't guarantee it'll rise to the top. For our band, things happened in reverse. By some mysterious exchange of fortune, we shot out of the gate with bells on. We became well-known nationally before we even put out a 7-inch, and this lasted for almost 2 years, but as fast as it came, oh so quickly, it disappeared. And then began the almost 4-year trudge of fighting our way through label rejection, scenester repudiation, and general reprisal. Looking back on it now, it was necessary and consequently very fortuitous. We grew thicker skin. It allowed us to appreciate what was earned and prove that we were in it for the long haul, despite whatever would be thrown at us. No matter what critics have said about our band over the years, no matter what music industry insiders have tainted us with, I'd like to think our longevity has proved them all wrong. But what kept our morale up during successive years of near stasis were quiet markers that indicated to us we should continue, be it a lukewarm review, an after-show compliment, or photos like the one I saw of Ron Heathman, guitarist of the Super Suckers, on their own website wearing our t-shirt in 2002. We started our band amidst the 90s rock and roll garage rock revival. Being from Toronto, 4 hours away from Detroit, allowed an even greater flow of Michigan bands to influence the scene. The Gories, the Dirt Bombs, the Demolition Doll Rods, the Detroit Cobras, the Go, and of course, the White Stripes. This scene, like every scene, had its principal players and lead groups. The John Spencer Blues Explosion from New York City, Rocket from the Crypt from San Diego, the New Bomb Turks from Columbus, Ohio, and the Super Suckers from Seattle, Washington. I got to know about the Super Suckers while they were on the Sub Pop label, putting out records like Sacrilicious Sounds and La Mano Cornuda. Despite the grunge tag that shadowed Sub Pop, the label was able to garner quite an impressive eclectic array of bands. Sure, they had Soundgarden and Nirvana, and sure, they teetered over to jangly indie pop from time to time, but a stable made up of the Dwarves, said Suckers, and later Murder City Devils and Zen Gorilla helped plant their feet firmly atop of rock and roll. Also, bands like Mudhoney, who seem to get perennially lumped in with the whole grunge thing, have always been a fantastic Stooges-influenced hard-driving rock and roll band, at least to me. After I saw the photo of Ron Heathman, there would always be someone every now and then telling me the Super Suckers knew of us and liked us. It was flattering to hear, especially since we'd been rejected by pretty much every American garage punk, rockabilly, indie rock, rock and roll label, and here was one of its chiefs approving of what we were doing. It was satisfying, to say the least. And finally, in 2005, an offer came through from the band to have us open for them on a short run they were doing in America that would end in their hometown of Seattle. As much as we wanted to do it, we couldn't. Logistically, from what was already booked, we wouldn't be able to make the drive back with all our gear. The Super Suckers then bent over backwards, and all we needed to do was bring our guitars and drumsticks. We could use all their gear. That's a big deal for a band to do, especially the headlining band to do for the opening band. So how could we turn that down? And it ended up being a great tour for us to do, too. Singer and bassist Eddie Spaghetti is one of the greatest frontmen I've ever seen. I put him in a small group of frontmen who I can watch all day and where their banter rival their own band's songs. There's always a strange connection between drummers and other bands when they meet. There's some sort of kinship immediately felt between the two of them. They all know each other too. It's weird. Bassists, on a lesser level, while guitarists each secretly think of themselves as better than the other. But when it comes to singers meeting and coming together, forget it. It's a breakthrough if we can talk about the weather with each other. Our egos loom so large, like invisible force fields smashing against each other. Usually behind closed doors, whenever dirt gets thrown around, it centers on how much the singer of the band is a total asshole. So, knowing this, I usually keep to myself, at the risk of being lumped in with the stereotype. At least, I don't have to deal with someone else's bullshit. But meeting Eddie Spaghetti was an honest-to-goodness mutual appreciation of what the other does. When I'd be on stage, I could see him in the crowd smiling, and it quickly became a game of trying to one-up myself in order to make Eddie laugh. And when the Super Suckers would go on stage, I'd watch from the side taking notes, and we'd both discuss the evening's banter afterwards. It was so much fun, something I've rarely gotten to do in all my years of performing on stage and touring. Last year, Eddie reached out and asked me to sing on their new album, which was released this year, called Get the Hell. I was pretty stoked. To be on a Super Suckers album with the great Eddie Spaghetti trading verses would be an immense honor. Something I take very seriously. But unfortunately, our touring schedule, coupled with their studio schedule, didn't line up. I wasn't able to get into a studio when they needed me to. And so, I had to bow out of the guest spot and let track number 7, entitled Gluttonous, stand on its own. It is hard to listen to when I do give the album a spin. It's hard knowing you're supposed to be on this song, and the song is good too. A month ago, when we recorded this episode, I went to see them play that night. I did end up singing 2 songs with the guys, but it wasn't Gluttonous, and when they did play it, I felt a longing pang. I should have been on stage singing that one with them too. When he's not traveling around the world, playing rock and roll, Eddie Spaghetti is a busy guy, putting out solo albums and co-hosting his own podcast, the Spaghetti Family Podcast. It's one of the few podcasts left that I listen to and shows another side to the hard rockin' man we all see on stage. This episode with Eddie is a long time coming. I've been wanting him on forever, but like the recording of Gluttonous, schedules and circumstances weren't able to line up until now. So thank you to Blue Mic Microphones for the Yeti mics, thank you to Skull Candy Headphones for the Aviator headphones, and thank you for taking the time out to listen to this episode. There's lots of podcasts out there, so I know everyone's time is precious, so thanks a lot for listening. Here's Nick Flanagan and I with Mr. Super Sucker himself, Eddie Spaghetti. There are points where Dan Bolton and Marty Chandler can be heard, so this is almost a group podcast. Anyways, Eddie's a guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's co-host, hello for free. I'm so glad I do sometimes. Jimmy in from fucked up, stop playing, hang down, down. Sometimes Danko goes on and on about Glenn Danzig. The guy just loves Glenn Danzig. And I love that kind of passion, and that's why I love listening to Danko speak. Well, truth be told, I love that Danzig song, Mother. I like that too. Thank God for the Danko Jones podcast. And I said the Danko Jones podcast. Nothing will stop. Sorry. We're not, this isn't a radio show. It's a podcast.
Intros. We have great intros to the Danko Jones podcast.
This is way more professional than usually than the impression we've given so far.
Picture you always like in a studio with your headphones on and like in a padded room,
right,
with black foam walls. And
look, we'll go through hell and high water to get you on the podcast. What have I done to get Eddie Spaghetti on this podcast? The last time you were here for your solo show, I showed up to the club with all my mics and my computer, but it wasn't working out.
It was an impossible place to find somewhere quiet enough to do this.
Yeah.
I think it was at the Bovine.
It was.
It's a loud bar.
It's a loud bar.
Cocktails are being mixed.
Right.
We're in Eddie's hotel room here, and someone just knocked on the door.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Thunder Bolton.
Dan Bolton. Hey, man, it's been a while.
Hey. How you doing, buddy?
Nice to see you. How you doing? We're recording.
Okay.
So, yeah. How you doing?
Hey. I could complain.
Of course. We all could.
Hi. Nice to meet you, Nick. Little interview going on here?
No, it's a podcast. Party. It's just a loosey-goosey podcast.
Caveman, back to my cave, all this technology. Do you have any messages
for the internet, Dan? Do you have any messages you'd like to send to the internet via this microphone?
Do not disturb. Do not reply to anything that people are doing. What's out there? That's my thing.
Housekeeping. Another sign on the door.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Thunder Bolton.
Yeah.
All his glory.
Anyway, I'm clapping like it's old school Howard Stern.
Like there's a bunch of people in here.
So, well, are you guys gonna walk? I mean, we are fellow podcasters. Okay. There's a few podcasts I subscribe later. To. See you guys later, man.
All right, see you in a bit.
Yeah.
You guys going to be at the show, correct?
Yeah, we will. Yeah.
Are you going to get up and do a song or something? Or
why don't you guys talk
work
about
something
this
out.
On your little podcast?
We'll work something out.
That we should do.
Shit.
Good luck.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll think of something.
All right.
We're all counting on you.
Yes, I too have a podcast
fellow
as well.
Fellow podcast.
The SpaghettiFamily.com is where you can find my... my works with my better half.
One of the many subscribers, I am one of those. it's a great podcast, and you guys have been doing it. You guys, there hasn't been a new episode lately, I don't think.
No, we're a little behind right now.
Okay. So
we have, I think there's one that's on ice that we haven't put out yet, and then there's a Q&A again we're going to do again. So
okay.
We'll have to do that soon.
What's your schedule like in terms of producing the podcast? Like what's the ideal every week?
The ideal is we try to do one a week,
mm-hmm.
but we've been way off that mark
lately.
3 weeks,
yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah. I'm behind on the episodes anyways. I haven't
seen him in years, and I co-host this thing.
Yeah. It's hard to get together, right?
I think I'm on like episode 25 or something. So I'm a few episodes behind.
Uh-huh.
But you guys don't do really long podcasts, so it's easy to go through two or three in one sitting anyway. So.
Yeah. They're usually, we try for a half hour, but sometimes we don't get there. Sometimes we go way over.
Did you have a model for the podcast like that you wanted to sort of not emulate, but just stuff that you like?
Not really. Yeah. The only podcasts I ever listen to are Danko's. And I listen to that Mark Maron guy sometimes.
Me too.
And I listen to a lot of sports podcasts.
Yeah.
So like when the Seahawks were doing really good last year, it was fun to listen to the NFL podcast. And when the Mariners are doing good, I like to listen to the baseball ones. But that's because I'm a nerd.
A sports nerd.
Sports nerd.
Right. Yeah. Different kind of nerd.
I remember before the Spaghetti Family podcast was up, you texted me going, how do you do this podcast thing?
Right, yeah. Right? I was kind of surprised at how complex it is to get it set up.
Mm-hmm.
Once it's set up, it's super easy and you just funnel it through your system. But like to get it set up, there's all these things you had to register for. And
see, I didn't do any of that. Our webmaster did that.
Oh, well,
yeah,
you're lucky.
There's a guy behind the scenes, Ole, who takes care of all that. But I'm the one who edits all of it. All the content I take care of. But
right.
then he does all the rest of the kind of administrative stuff. And I don't know. Yesterday I got an email going. There's something about iTunes that they're switching something over. So I had to resubscribe to the podcast. So maybe that's something you guys should look into.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This is like a thing going on with the internet now that's a problem, I would say. Just putting a little personality into my delivery. Okay, so YouTube, right, is owned by Google. And they can just change the terms of services whenever they want. And iTunes does this with every single update, right? So if they change something, that could mean you have to do a bunch of stuff over again. We're at the mercy of these digital overlords.
Well, you save, what can we do about this?
You save all your old podcasts just in case. Evolution. You've got them all archived, I'm assuming. Yeah. So just in case the ship goes down, you can always kind of build it up again.
Right.
But have you noticed doing the podcast? Is there any kind of like, on tour, do people come up to you going, hey, number 27, man, what was going on last week? Or some, do they make
yeah,
reference directly?
Sometimes they do, yeah. And it's always interesting to hear that people actually listen. Mm-hmm. Like, because, you know, it gets to a point where we just kind of feel like it's, I don't know, it's almost like therapy for me and my wife just to sit there and shoot the shit like that, like with the idea that somebody might hear it.
Right.
And it's been cool to hear people actually respond to it and like it, and people give me shit because we're a little behind. It's cool that I'm like, well, thank you. I'm glad that you care.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's the PayPal button. I'm glad you care. This is a way to see some more of them faster. Hand me cash.
true story, right? Yeah.
JD also is an author now.
She is.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's a great, you sent me the book in kind of a digital format.
Uh-huh.
Before it got released, so I read it, and I thought it was great. How is it doing? What's it called again? The Chicken and the...
The Turkey and Mr. Bear.
Turkey and Mr. Bear. How's it doing?
It did really well, actually. Her sales goal, and she met it and surpassed it by quite a bit, so...
Are you taking advantage of the whole Thanksgiving around the corner thing?
Yeah, that was the idea, to put the book out now before Thanksgiving.
And right.
Even though it's, you know, it's for any holiday, really, but... You know, Thanksgiving is the money shot for Turkey and Mr. Bear, for sure.
Right. It's an interesting thing when you kind of, because a friend of mine put out a children's book, and when you delve into that world, it is cutthroat, man. It is so highly competitive.
It really is.
More so than anybody really realizes.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, anytime you put adults in charge of anything, it's going to get like that. But you don't think of the children's book market as being such a hard-nosed. There's all these rules about what, you know, you're self-published, so we can't do anything for you. Let me know when you get a real publisher.
Right.
And meanwhile, you know, she feels like she is a real publisher. She went through all the steps to start up this, you know, get her barcode and all that sort of shit and get it be totally legit. And, still resistance from the powers that be.
I know in writing for children's television, there's like a lot of restrictions and stuff, but I wonder if it's a self-published children's book, do you like impose your own restrictions, or was there some knowledge of what could go in there? You know, there's weird stuff.
That's a good question, because the story is a little
behavior,
dark.
That kind of stuff, you know?
I mean, the story has a dark twist to it.
Yeah, there is a dark... And third act to it.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
It's inevitable.
Right.
You see it coming.
Turkey story.
Right.
But, I mean, what's that Henny Penny, the Henny Penny story?
Well, old children's books were insane, though.
Right, yeah. The Grimm, those Brothers Grimm or whatever, those were, you know,
dark, the oldest
dark
stuff.
Tales for children.
Roald
like
Dahl.
The sky's falling, Henny Penny, that story.
Right. Yeah.
That's crazy.
What was Little Rabbit Foo Foo? That didn't go well, did it? Little Rabbit I'm not going to sing it, but Little Bunny Foo Foo was walking through the forest. No?
I don't know.
Song of the South?
Might be a Canadian.
I'm just naming. No, maybe it is. There was a lot of Canadian stuff. Actually, a lot of Canadian children's stuff was very dark, you know. Or Sesame Street, Mr. Hooper dying. That was hard for us to take. Does anyone remember that?
Did he die on the show?
He died on the show.
Yeah, they had to deal with it. I remember that.
Wow.
Yeah. I think nobody out there even remembers Mr. Hooper.
If you want to watch a funny video.
I remember Mr. Hooper. I don't remember him dying.
He died and David took over the store.
Getting back to why we're in a hotel room with you, your hotel room. Why are you here? You're on tour.
We're on tour. Super Suckers are out spreading the evil, which we've been doing a lot this year.
Yeah, obviously noticed. How was Australia?
Oh, it's great. Yeah, Australia was super fun and we did a European tour recently also that went really well. The Spanish shows were off the hook. And
was that with Nashville Pussy?
No. No, it wasn't. We did one with them a couple years back.
Right.
Over there.
What were the Spanish crowds like? Like, what was so awesome about the Spanish shows?
They're just so into it. Yeah. I mean, they're just really there, and they, like, know the words, or, you know, they phonetically know where the words are supposed to go anyway. And it's just super fun to play there. And to go from there to France for us is such a letdown. Right. Like, the French crowds, you know, they show up, but they, you know, they kind of barely get into it, and they're just very... French about everything.
They want to have a conversation after the show.
But Nashville Pussy is awesome in France. They do go, amazing. They go France, nuts for them in France.
What's the logic? What's the logic to like what European country responds? You know,
Blaine is the Jerry Lewis of rock and roll.
He is the Jerry Lewis of French punk rock.
Speaking of Blaine, though, we were supposed to be in a band together, you and I, with Blaine. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
years ago.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be like this kind of rock and roll, like garage rock and roll version of the Traveling Wilburys.
Right.
I think that's how he pitched it to me.
Yeah, me too.
And I think it was you. It was the three of us. Those were his first top picks. And then I think I mentioned Mick Collins. And then I pitched Mick to you, and you were into it.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't – and I think I even mentioned it to Mick somehow.
Oh, yeah?
In passing, yeah. But I don't think – I never heard – from Blaine about it again.
Yeah, it was one of his. He sent me some ideas for country songs a while ago. Him and I were going to write some hit country songs for other artists.
Right, okay.
And that idea stalled out too, so.
The Traveling Wilburys idea between you, me, Mick Collins, and Blaine, that, I mean, they were a five-piece band though, right?
Yeah, there was like, we need one more guy.
I mean, who would it be? I mean,
Harmar Superstar? Well, you can be the Orbison.
It could be like Black Dahlia, perhaps.
Oh yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, that works.
Hey, if this is a real thing, I'm in. Yeah. That would be insane.
Yeah, that would be Hamilton? Really great. Just to get Mick Collins and Black Dahlia in the same room would be worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then for them to be in the same band.
Yeah.
I'll feel like I'm photobombing all our group shots.
Yeah, me too. I don't want to belong here.
Like Traveling Wilburys of every genre now with this.
No one's done that. No one's actually uprooted that idea and taken it for themselves. I was all on board.
Right.
It's like, wow. And this is like going back, fuck, can I say like 8 years ago?
Maybe, yeah.
Revive it.
We're doing it right now, man.
Wrestling it from the floors of the dead right now.
And it's easier to do now because we could all just pass stuff through digital files.
Right,
yeah.
The internet makes any supergroup possible.
Yeah.
It's true.
Skype Jam.
Yeah.
But isn't supergroup...
Skype Jam.
Like the commercials? Remember
these from our record, Skype Jam.
Well, that would be the video.
Yeah,
just cutting from each of our living rooms.
Feels like that. Like didn't Bon Jovi have videos like that in one of their like comeback periods? And like
no, this Def Leppard. Def Leppard had a video where they followed a T-shirt, and then finally that T-shirt was bought on eBay by this fan, and there's probably I think some tie-in to where it originally came from or something. Some Def Leppard rock and roll merch T-shirt.
Like a newer Def Leppard video? It must have been pretty new.
Yeah, a new one.
It references eBay.
Yeah. So I'm saying the last maybe 5-6 years.
Right.
And then the girl buys the shirt at the end or something, and you follow the shirt's history when it was, you know, first sold and then who wore it and all this stuff, and then it's bought on eBay now.
That's what it's come to. Def Leppard is now making nerd videos.
Yeah. I have a joke.
All right.
Did I mention Eddie? He's a stand-up comedian. Sorry. I just introduced him as Nick.
All right.
But he is a comedian.
No drummers were armed in the making of this.
Right. I got you.
All right.
I do have a Rick Allen story. We played with Def Leppard last year.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Well, we played. And Rick Allen... I guess we didn't really, we used our dressing room before the show, and then after, I don't know where we didn't really go back to it until the end of the evening, and so it had remained empty. And then when two of the guys went in, they realized Rick Allen was in our washroom, and I walked in, and I was like, what the hell? You guys are just frozen. What's going on? Someone was in, he walks out, and he did a number two in our washroom. To JC and our tech Paul, and then he felt totally embarrassed, but he like I think there was like a moment of like a greeting, but you don't want to shake the guy's hand.
Right.
Because you
he
don't
was
know.
Was just wiping
yeah,
his
we
ass
We just
with
knew
that
what
hand.
He did. Yeah, yeah. He found like a secluded toilet and it was our dressing room.
Fist bump.
Maybe.
Chest
maybe.
Bump.
Chest bump.
Chest bump, yeah.
A little
one less arm to get in the way.
With Rick Allen, yeah.
Yeah.
With Rick Allen, the drummer.
Was he short?
Of
was he shorter than you?
No, he was our height.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so he wasn't, I guess he looked shorter because, like, I think Joe Elliott's kind of tall, isn't he?
Yeah, Joe tall. Elliott's pretty tall.
Yeah, but that was our run-in with Def Leppard. And then afterwards, he sent someone to apologize on his behalf, which was nice.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's like some
bottle of Febreze.
She just knocked on her door and she's like, Rick's really embarrassed, real sorry about that. And then later on, I was hanging out around their world, and Rick walked by me and he just went, yeah. Just like shrugged his shoulders, laughed, and tilted his head, going, nah, I'm sorry.
Right.
So it was all it was cool. I'm like, hey man. We got a story for life, man.
Yeah,
that's
no
not
doubt.
Bad.
That's one of those gross brushes with fame.
Yeah.
Don't
yeah.
hear about that much.
Yeah. But yeah, that's my Def Leppard
story. Orson Welles blew up my dad's bathroom and then his general store he owned in 1965.
But getting back to it, how long is this tour?
Long. We don't get home until middle of December. Mm.
That is long.
So we're
that's
gonna.
That's like a long tour.
Yeah, we started on the 22nd of October in Vancouver, and we're gonna go. We have like I think 17 Canadian shows, and then a bunch of U.S. shows.
So that's like 2 months.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah, close to 2 months.
Have you done a 2 month tour lately?
Yeah, it seems like all the tours have been pretty long. We just did 27 shows in 27 days
yeah.
in Europe, so that was wasn't 2 months, but it felt like
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really
it was,
intense.
It was a
that
brutal schedule.
Wow. Well, that's awesome that you guys are doing a grueling schedule like that.
Yeah.
I call it grueling because that's the word I used when someone proposes that, and I use that word in my email back to them.
Yeah, I hear you there, yeah. We usually say, we don't like too many days off. And we never really expect a booking agent to take that literally. Like, mm-hmm. They say they don't want any days off, so no days off.
How's that for you as a singer, having to sing a full set every night with no days to recoup?
Generally, it's fine. Like, I don't have any problem. I don't think I really sing in the right way you're supposed to sing, so mm-hmm. the damage is minimal. I mean,
it's been years of the same.
Right,
thing.
I just do
yeah.
it. I do it the same way every time, and mm-hmm. it does what it does, and it's generally pretty easy for me to do. But I had like a couple of days where I wasn't feeling very well, and I never ever get sick. I mean, I never ever get sick.
Isn't that kind of like making that statement? Isn't that? Aren't you inviting something?
It's like a fuck you to God.
I say it all the time. Though,
okay, all right.
I never get sick, but I did get sick for there was like 2 days. And I was like, man, this is what it feels like to get sick. It sucks.
Yeah. And, so did you cancel?
No.
Damn.
I did it anyway.
Fucking. What was it? What kind of sickness are you talking about? Sniffles or?
Yeah, I had like a fever? Respiratory thing, like where it was like I was coughing a lot, and I couldn't get a restful sleep because I was coughing so much. Yeah.
How about the fever?
You're exhausted. Ugh.
Fever will flatten.
No, I had no fever.
Oh, okay, so you can power through that.
Yeah.
So just tired and coughing. Basically.
Yeah, just my bones felt heavy and achy. And...
On tour, that is like a brutal thing, though.
Sure. We had long drives.
Yeah, people think you're just whining.
Right.
But when you got to perform and you got to put on the whole show, and it rests on your shoulders no matter what anybody says.
Oh,
and
for sure.
You're the front man of the band.
Right.
The sleep thing is also such a big deal to know that you kind of like go home and then it's like you don't reset it because you can't rest and then like the
I get more sleep on the road actually.
Oh, me too. By a mile.
Yeah.
Because I have 3 kids.
Yeah. Right.
So I get way more sleep on the road, like a guiltily a large amount of sleep on the road.
How old are your kids?
I have a 2-year-old, mm-hmm. a 5-year-old, and a 13-year-old.
Okay. So when you do like a 2-month kind of trip like this, like is that at what's the conversation like? How's that kind of explained to the kids?
Well, they know that's what I do. I mean, this is all I've ever done.
You just play Gone Till November for them?
Right. I'm just, I'm always gone.
Quatro is your oldest.
Yeah.
And I met Quatro back in 05.
Uh-huh.
When we played together, just you solo, we played with Turbo Negro.
Yeah, in Portland.
And I thought Quatro was what? He must have been, 2005, was he?
Five.
He was five.
Four.
Four or five, yeah.
Yeah, four or five.
And I guess I could say this, because people probably don't know the story. Maybe you've told it, but he was walking around with Hank's makeup. You put Hank's makeup on. I thought he was the coolest kid.
Yeah.
He was like, he was really on. And I was like, wow, that kid is miles beyond. I didn't know kids. Like, I don't hang out with five-year-olds. I didn't, but he was definitely like, he seemed a little older than, he was keeping up with all us adults backstage, right.
That's where he grew up pretty much was, he spent his whole, from 0 to 5 basically, or right. 6 until he started school on a regular, he spent it on the road with me. So, I mean, he was very comfortable around adults and he still is. So, and that's a great quality to have in a kid. 'Cause so many of his friends, like, they can't look you in the eye. They're like, hi, Quatro's dad.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, they don't want to look at you, and he's very direct. I see him with other adults, and he's like, looks them in the eye, shakes their hand, and
yeah,
meets people like an adult.
And then I can't remember the city, but it was like when we were out on tour with you guys as the band, and I saw Quatro again, and I think Ron's daughter was there too, and he was so welcoming to her. These like little kids, I thought that was very memorable too. Like, wow, he can hang with the adults, but also he's very welcoming to like kids his age as well.
Right.
Yeah. I don't mean to go on about it, but I have gone on about Quatro to other people. Like, I'm like, you should meet Eddie Spaghetti, and in my head he's like 5 years old.
Right.
So and when I see photos from the Spaghetti Family Podcast, I'm like, so that's Quatro? Oh, no, that's Quatro, the tall, like, teenager.
Right, yeah.
Right?
He's a teenager now.
Yeah, yeah.
Surly, grouchy, grumpy, difficult to wake up in the morning teenager.
Right,
impossible to get him to go to bed, impossible to get him to get out of bed.
Listening to what kind of music?
Good music.
Classical music, right, I would assume?
He's listening
to Rebel?
He's listening to, like, he likes the Ramones,
yeah.
Weezer a lot, Super Suckers,
dubstep,
Danko Jones.
Okay, so the dubstep hasn't entered.
No, there's no dubstep. There's no like pop music.
Yeah.
Like that whole era of like, I don't know, One Direction or whatever has not entered his world at all. He can't stand that sort of crap. So
I was probably 13 or 12 when I first heard Super Suckers, which is kind of interesting thing that your son is like also that age. Because I immediately was like, I'm in. Because it was Smoke of Hell, Mano Cornuda, and I was just like, there was something that was like rebellious and obviously catchy and stuff about it. So it's kind of interesting to think of that also happening to your own song.
Right, yeah.
He
basically likes stuff that he hears from my record collection, so yeah, right, I'm right. good with that.
Right,
yeah.
Because I would think, like, just to rebel against your dad, you would just, like, get into, if my dad was Eddie Spaghetti, I'd be, like, into jazz and...
Right.
Classical.
I've been trying to think of the, right, because he's about at the age when I started getting turned on to music,
mm-hmm.
and I started trying to think of what was like the first record that I really fell in love with, and one of them was Rumors.
Yes.
And so I, turned him on to that record, and he's been listening to that like nonstop. He's like, man, that's so good. I'm like, I'm so glad you like that record, because it's a great record. It only has like 2 songs that I would want to skip over, and they're the Christine McVie songs, I think, but. right. Other than those couple songs, it's a fucking great record.
Right, right. Oh, that's interesting. Because I honestly would, just rebellious nature, I would definitely get into just to piss off my dad.
Right.
I think that the real thing too, if your dad's a musician, is just you go, I don't really like music.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be.
I really like it.
Yeah, interesting.
I like movies, but I don't like music.
Yeah, I want to get.
I like TV.
I like TV. I don't like the music in the shows. Like, really, just.
I just like the plot and
yeah.
I skip
over
the.
Do you trust somebody who actively says they don't like or listen to music?
No, I don't think so. I would like admire their balls. If somebody is like that, anytime someone really gives me like a firm, I don't like this.
I'm obsessed immediately with, like, why don't they do this? How do they have this kind of willpower? You know, like, right. Like that.
I don't eat ice cream.
Don't eat ice cream, you know. I'm a vegetarian.
But there are those people who just cannot connect with music.
Right.
Yeah. They just can't connect with it.
And there's something, their brain is broken somehow.
Yeah, and they can hum a tune. For them. Like, you know, they know a tune. Or whatever right.
They're familiar with the idea of music.
Right.
They know what music is, and they hear it every day. Every time they listen to TV or watch TV, they hear music.
Yeah. Like, they can hum the commercial or the TV right. theme song, but they
don't need to chase anything down.
No, they're not. Know? Yeah, exactly.
They're not ever pretending they're like,
oh, what was that? Oh,
right.
Like, no one, they don't care.
Nothing turns
There are on. Those people. I look right. at them like aliens, but I don't put them down as much as I used to, is what I'm trying to get at. I'm trying to understand them.
What threw me off too is like the hip hop attitude, right? The rap attitude often, especially in like the mid 90s to 2000s, suddenly became more like almost sports. Like, it was super competitive, and it was about, you know, being as good at that as possible, producing as much, you know, practicing. And it was like, it's just so different, like such a different approach to music than I'd ever seen right. before, you know? And it's
right.
like,
yeah, the rappers kind of brought stats into the game.
Yeah.
They did.
Stats, and also like this sort of individuality that was like different than, say, like Frank Sinatra or something. It was it's hard to explain. Like,
well, that's the difference between sports and music. I mean, sports is very objective. You have like specific numbers that you look at a guy's career, and the numbers tell you the story.
Yeah,
I mean, there's nothing subjective about it at all. Whereas music, you know, you can feel like.
Yeah,
like, I feel like the Super Suckers are as good as any band that has ever been. Mm-hmm. Any band, AC/DC, the Ramones, Motorhead. I mean, I'm including every band. I feel like we're as good as any band has ever been. And we're just, you know, our numbers don't say that. But right. I can still feel like I can say that because it's a subjective thing.
No
it's,
one you know, can take art. That away from you or the people of Spain.
Or, right.
You know. I don't know.
Maybe people of France people? Can take it away from you?
The people of maybe France have taken it away from me. The people have spoken in general, and they don't agree with my assessment of the Super Suckers at all. So there's that.
Right.
Have you ever found yourself on any kind of like a weird list? You know how like life is lists now, like musical reviewing is lists and stuff. Have you ever been like, oh, I'm on the list of like 30 of the greatest 90s Seattle thing. You know what I mean? Like,
no.
No, oh
I don't
God.
I don't think we ever even make a list.
Damn it. I'd put you on a list. I'm going to write a list now. Well,
didn't the Ramones only go gold last year? Finally, yeah. They went gold officially
yeah.
through sales and everything. That's yeah. a comforting fact I keep close.
Yeah, for sure. You know? Yeah, the Ramones have only been recognized posthumously pretty much.
Yeah. I mean,
They never put out a really crappy record. Maybe Pleasant Dreams is pretty bad.
Yeah, there's a couple, but I hesitate to say on the record.
But right. they tend to have at least a song or two on a lot of their albums.
Even the crappiest yeah. record has a KKK Took My Baby
yeah.
Away on it.
Yeah,
I love that song.
Pet Sematary is on one of those albums.
Oh, that's later. What you're saying. Right. I thought you were putting down that song.
No, that's a great song yeah. on a crappy record.
Yeah, right, right.
I just read Johnny Ramone's autobiography. I hadn't read it before, and it totally put me in a really good way towards Johnny Ramone, because I was going through some sort of, I'd made up my own canon where I was like,
yeah, there's
Joey,
stories.
He took Joey's girl, and he's just this mean, he's this Republican meanie, and he's just not nice to anybody.
That's
and
my then, assessment.
Yeah, and then when I read, and that's true.
So I have to read the book.
It's true, but then you read it, and you're like, well, this is a guy who did have, like, an artfulness to him, a plan, and I think a lot of affection, even for Joey. It's just like, I don't think there was any way, I don't think he was correctly communicative.
There's no way yeah. for him to appropriately show it in his masculine code.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Would not allow
exactly
him
it.
To show mm-hmm. any sort of affection or appreciation
right.
for
yeah.
anybody.
And,
I have a great Johnny Ramone story.
Okay.
We were on tour with the Ramones for a brief period in the mid-90s when we were on tour with White Zombie. The Ramones were the main support and we were the opener. And so we were on tour with them for like a week. It was the whole reason we took the White Zombie tour to begin with. And so Johnny comes, we're backstage playing poker with CJ a lot on that tour because CJ was great and we played a lot of poker back then. So we were playing poker with CJ and Johnny would come back to our room. You guys mind if I stand in here? I'm like, no, of course, you're Johnny Ramone. You can stand wherever you want. We're happy to have you here. And he's like, yeah, okay, well, what's going on in your dressing room? Yeah, Joey's in there. Or what's he doing? Is he warming up? Or is he, no, he's just fucking standing there. I'm like, and you can't be around. I can't be around that fucking guy when he's just standing there like that. He's just fucking standing there. So we're going to go on stage, and I realize I don't have a pick. And he's like, here, take one of these. And I'm like, look at it. It's like one of those Fender plastic picks that I know I'm going to break immediately.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm going to break this. Thanks, but I'm going to break. He's like, you can't break that pick. I've been playing these things for 20 years or whatever. And he's like, I never broke one. I'm like, all right, I'm going to break it. I'm going to show it to you. And I come back. I break it like the second song, and I have to grab one from Dan or whatever. And after the show, I go, I'm like, check it out. It's broken. He's like, man, you're a fucking animal.
That's awesome.
So Johnny Ramone called me an animal.
That's amazing, that man. That's awesome. Now, do you have that pick? You still have it,
yes,
right?
I still have it.
Fuck, that's,
that rules.
Yeah. That's an amazing story.
It's one of those white picks that say Ramones in like the type letters across the front of it.
Oh, so it does have the Ramones on the pick.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I
thought it just said Fender Heavy.
No,
you
but
can
I
prove it to anybody.
Right. You can totally tell that it's
That's so cool.
Ramones sanctioned material.
That's so cool.
All right, yeah, I gotta
go. You gotta go, man. Yeah. I don't wanna. It's all good. Thanks, man, for doing this.
Right on. Thank you, Danko.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Nick.